Hello?
Oh no, she's dead.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
It's all shits and giggles till somebody dies.
Hello and good afternoon. Welcome to Death A Funny Business with...
What's my name?
Natasha.
Spencer-Levy.
And
Becky Briggs.
That's us. We're here today to talk about how funny death can be.
Yep. My mum's dead and so's her dad.
Yeah.
True story.
But we're here to kind of make light out of a rubbish situation.
Yeah, light out of the darkness. Let's break some taboos. Let's open up
that discussion.
Let's open up those doors.
And talk about it, because it's not all crap, is it?
Well, at the end of the day, it's something that everyone on the damn planet will share. Because either way,
you're either
going to know someone who's going to die, or you're going to do it yourself. And in fact, not all, you just will.
We're all
doomed.
Right.
But ain't that exciting? Doesn't that make you want to live?
So exciting. So what have we got coming up then today?
Well, we have lots coming up. Shall I actually look at my papers?
We've got LK, a taxidermist. I'm going to find out a lot about
which
that
later.
Which
is one of my favourite forms of art, just want to say.
Interesting.
I love that crap. Do you remember when we grew up and there was that little museum in the library?
Oh, yeah.
In T Wells, they had this little taxidermy... And I used to go in there and I used to look at all the little birds and animals and I used to think, this is so cool.
And then we have Fraser. Fraser, who is a...
Another T Wells.
I think he is. A Movember ambassador. Because it is actually Mental Health Week this week. So I feel like we are kind of tapping into that this
absolutely.
Week. So we've got him coming in and we're going to have a chat to him. And that's
else.
What we've got coming up.
How's your week been?
My week.
Have you had a good week?
You have
for those who can't see her, she's wearing a very nice shirt today.
Thank you. I wasn't really sure about this.
I really like it.
I've kind of like walked around all day feeling a little bit like, oh, what am I wearing? You know, I'm kind of giving myself the current
ick. I think it was a good choice.
It's the corduroys. I felt like they were really in about 4 years ago. And then
now, what are you talking about? I love the corduroys.
But, you know.
Okay, well, so.
And I didn't want to be in all black, so that'd be quite depressing. And we were kind of matching.
We kind of went for like a little
this
red.
This is kind of nice.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, it's that moment, guys. Whoa. Stevie Nicks' Fall is here. Just want to say, so let's talk about death. Let's do it.
Let's do it. It's a funny fucking business.
It's hilarious.
FUBAR Radio.
Hello, Elle. We are here with LK today,
yay,
an award-winning taxidermist. She was selected as the taxidermist for the Natural History Museum, London's exhibit.
Just
Birds,
one more time.
Brilliant and bizarre.
So cool.
I don't even know where to start. I'm so excited.
Freaking cool.
I will start by saying hello. Thank you so much for having me.
No, thank you for coming into the studio.
So exciting.
The Natural History Museum is one of my favorite places on the planet. I was just saying to Becky that back at home where we grew up, we had this tiny little taxidermy museum. And I used to love it. I think it's so cool. I've always been obsessed with like the little, you know how they make them all like sweet on the little mossy patches? Love that crap.
The diorama.
Yes, the diorama.
We love a diorama.
And I have a confession. I didn't know what a taxidermist was.
She didn't.
You know what? That's absolutely fine because 9 times out of 10 people think I'm either a tax attorney or a taxi driver.
Wow.
So you're in great company.
Yeah.
No, I didn't have any assumptions, I promise you.
No,
I just didn't know. So for stupid people like me, can you tell people what it is that you do?
For stupid people like Becky.
I will caveat and say that it's not stupid people because it's not a commonplace word. It's definitely not a commonplace profession. Which is probably why you've got me on this conversation with you girls. But taxidermist is somebody that mounts animals for preservation sciences, so for museums, but also for things like prop and film hire, also for the value of art as like a 3D sculpture, as an object that someone might see in their home as something beautiful. Because birds are beautiful, and I will just let you know that I specialize in birds, so it's only birds.
I do have a question. What's like, can you taxidermy? What's the verb? Taxidermy?
To taxidermy.
Can you taxiderm anything?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, within reason, any animal.
Like, what's the biggest what's the biggest animal do you think that someone's taxidermed?
Well, I've seen like a taxidermed tiger.
Yeah. I mean, I used to work for another taxidermist and they specialized in kind of big African game. So we were doing things like giraffe and Nyala and that kind of the big stuff. So, I mean, I definitely have had my hand in zebras, lions, that kind of thing.
Wow. Okay, how did you get into doing this? Where did we start?
Yeah, where did this start?
Okay,
school. So she's just in the classroom, like, stuffing
like you
tiny
in primary
birds.
School.
Oh, yeah.
Well, no, as in that you saw them and you were inspired.
Oh,
right?
Yes, exactly.
Well, ironically, I was kind of the opposite. So I probably would have been hard-pressed to tell you what a taxidermist was growing up. I mean, I would have gone to natural history museums, but it definitely wasn't on my radar. I actually wanted to be a vet.
Oh, okay.
So we're in the same.
we're regional. Okay.
What noises do birds make?
What do you mean?
Well, I don't know.
I can only do a tawny owl.
Can you do that?
Can you do it? Do it.
I can't whistle, but I can do a tawny owl.
Oh my gosh.
Which is quite a niche.
I think we should save the tawny owl for the end.
Okay, so that's the end. Sorry.
Tell me about how taxidermy was.
Okay, so wanted to be a vet.
Amazing.
When I was at school. I was very much creative and more like a kind of drama kid, dancer,
nice,
artistic.
Friends.
And I felt like that spark for science just wasn't really fostered. Like I was interested, but it didn't come naturally to me. So I was very much taught that art and science were separate. And if you weren't good at one, then leave it.
Yeah.
Leave it alone.
Yeah.
And move on and do the thing that you're good at. So I actually went off and studied sculpture. Because I realized I couldn't be a vet. I realized I didn't have the academic brain that you need, like math and biology.
Blech.
So,
yuck.
Right? Am I right?
Who wants math?
We do words and art.
Yeah,
we do
sparkly stuff. I'm not interested in doing the numbers.
Not for
percentages?
Me. What is that?
Who? No. Okay, no. Let's move away
That's
from my hatred
like
of math.
That's why I don't like adulting, because you have to do that.
Isn't it the worst?
Horrendous.
I hate it.
I just want to mount my little birds.
That's what she said. Anyway.
So
you're sculpturing.
I went off to be a sculptor.
Yeah.
And I still didn't really know what it was that I wanted. I kept trying to leave, and something kept pulling me back, mostly my dad. He was like, you can stay. Just find something that you're into. So I went to my tutor as a kind of last resort, and I was like, look, I'm not feeling it. I don't feel like I gel here. My peers didn't get me. I didn't get myself. I didn't really know who I was. And so he said, well, what are you into? I said, I love birds. And he said, well, why don't you try taxidermy?
No way.
So obviously you have the sculptural element, but you also have the anatomical and biological.
Yeah, you got to do a lot of chemical stuff, don't you?
So it kind of was ticking all the boxes, and it allowed me to access science and animals through a creative way.
Amazing.
So it was a perfect marriage, and I went to the local bookshop. I pulled some literature on like tanning a hide with a deer's brain. Because a lot of the resources were very outdated, like written in the 1800s and the 1900s and old. So we've changed that. Like me and my peers, we're changing that. So
okay.
So good. So if you're listening and you want to be a taxidermist, come join us.
We've got
sparkly resources for you. I went to the local pet shop and I was like, look, so if you lose an animal, which happens, right? Because they've taken care of these animals, they're custodians while they wait for an interim for the, you know, housing these animals. Things do die.
Oh,
would you just keep it for me? You know, just like pop that bad boy in the freezer.
You little devil.
And so
this is insane.
It's
amazing.
Creepy.
No, it's
creepy.
Not creepy. It's just
no, but it's just ingenious. Like I think it's so. I always find it so interesting when people's brains work in different ways. Like I would never ever think like. Oh, you know how I can do this? Mm. I'll ask, like, pet shops to just give me their dead things.
Right.
Well, this
or
is
I'll put
what
an
I was
going to
ask.
Facebook
like, where does it start? Like, you know, how do you collect these dead birds? And then, you know, where do you put them? And then what's the process?
So into the freezer, because the freezer is a great tool for, like, keeping things into limbo. So when you think of food, when it's in the freezer, it's not going to degrade.
Mm. But I normally forget about things in the freezer. That's the problem.
It's just like a steak in the
back.
So
I hope that
cupboard.
You didn't remember those things.
Yeah. My housemates.
Behind the dead body.
Yeah, my housemates are laughing down the end of this right now. They're like, yup, that sounds correct.
The process.
Yeah.
Please.
I would say it's kind of like a three-part process. So you have the, is it dinner time? I'm just thinking about how
it is, but you know what? People are, the people who are listening are just gonna, they know what they're here for at the end of the day. We literally talk about
tell us.
And embalming all the time.
Okay,
so
speaking
you're
my
good.
Language. Okay. So the first part of the process will be skinning and the removal of the skin from the carcass. I told you.
Yeah, totally. So chill.
Once you have... I actually find that part of the process really cathartic because it's because it's so... I mean, it's a process, right? So you have to follow the same formula each time to get the end result. And so you kind of get into this autopilot mode.
Yeah.
And it allows you to, you know, I tend to work in silence, but it allows me to think, but also to not think sometimes, you know, depending on where my mental health is at.
Yeah.
So yeah, I love that part of process. I love is probably a word that sounds weird, to taxidermy.
Because it sounds like you're crafting. Yeah. It sounds like
someone
who's crocheting or
something. Yeah, I mean, I started
drawing.
Doing paint by numbers the other week.
Oh,
and
amazing.
I haven't finished it because I can't finish anything. But the process was so fun. Yeah. It was literally just like I was
zoned in.
I couldn't care less what was happening outside of my life.
Eyes on the prize.
And I'm not saying that I'd be very good at taxidermy, but I can understand the whole flow state, getting into
That's
it.
That's it, you've nailed it. And I feel like you would be good because painting by numbers,
skinning
a damn
arm. I can't get in the
same
lines,
thing.
But
right,
yeah.
right,
because that's just the. I mean, if you can, isn't it what they say? If you can paint by numbers, you can skin a dead animal. And if you can skin a dead animal, if you can skin it, you can join the Royal Navy.
There we go.
Is that it?
I've never heard it.
I think I know what you're trying to say. Okay, sorry. Sorry, we interrupted you. So we skin the animal, and then what happens?
We do it, and then once we have the skin removed from the carcass, we want to be preserving that skin. Okay, so we want all of our taxidermy to outlive us. We want to do things by the book and make sure that the preservative is super hot. No cutting of corners. And so we will preserve the skin. I go through a dual preservation technique, and I'm kind of like, I like my health, so I try to use things that are not noxious. I try to approach it in a really sustainable, like semi-organic way. So we're using things that you would find around the home, sodium carbonate, salts, camphor oil, like the sort of menthol oils, stuff that isn't super dangerous. So taxidermy is very much the sort of thing you could do in your home if you wanted to, and it'd be safe, which is great for beginners or for people that are like, I might dabble.
Sounds like a craft I could get behind.
Right. Painting by numbers is what I meant. Painting by numbers, taxidermy. Same difference.
See me next week. I'll be around yours.
I think we should be doing
it. I'll have you over. and then the next part is the process is you're creating your anatomically accurate model. So what you took out of the skin, or rather what the skin came off, we need to recreate that. And it needs to be recreated pretty close to what the anatomy was, what it stood for. Otherwise, it's not going to have any semblance of
animal.
Yeah, you wouldn't have that weight distribution. You wouldn't have the center of gravity. Ultimately, your mannequin should look like a bird without its skin on. It should still have that kind of sense of mobility and structure. And, you know.
Can I ask a question?
You do. You.
Are the bones inside there?
Great question. So we do keep some bones, but not all of the bones. So I keep the skull.
Like a skull, because that's quite intense, isn't it, to try and
recreate.
It's
very formative for the face.
Very thin.
Also, we keep the ulna and radius, which are the wing bones, and the
little legs.
Femur, tibia, and one of the like metatarsus bones. Ooh. I'm getting technical.
Yeah. Oh, little tiny legs.
I know, the legs are so cute. But yeah, that's basically the process. And then
that's amazing.
To finish it off, you very harmoniously. You combine your preserved skin that's washed and bubble bathed and blow dried with the anatomically accurate model, and then boom, you have a perfect.
Wow.
With some flair.
I have so many questions I want to ask you, but we have to wrap up. But I want to know, what are like the biggest misconceptions around taxidermy?
That we dislike animals, that we're motivated by brutality, and also that we're psychopaths and serial killers.
I mean,
we see it as a craft. We see it as...
But they're dead.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we see it as something like, why not... If we think birds are beautiful, animals are beautiful, why not bring them into the homes and bring us closer to nature,
which
we all
need. Do you have in your home?
Actually, none.
Really?
What?
Not
that's
a keep.
So interesting that you don't.
It's
have...
my work, so it's that kind of thing
you
of like
keep it away from.
Totally,
I get you.
And also, I am quite sentimentally and emotionally attached to my work, so I feel like I would, if I had them in the home, it would
it
never
would feel.
I'd never make any money.
No,
put it that way.
Can I ask you one more question before you leave? Is there a specific piece that you've done that's like you always think about, you want to kind of tell people about? Is there one like in the Natural History Museum, or is there?
So I might just
please plug
the
yourself
on your question and make it two specimens,
please.
Because I had the incredible fortune to do two enormous white-tailed eagles for the exhibition that you mentioned, and just like the sheer scale of these birds and the labor that was involved, it was incredibly taxing and like a lot of pressure, because they had to be structurally really sound. And yeah, I was just, it's a pretty cool feeling to walk into the exhibition and have this enormous eagle just flying above you and be like, ha, I did that.
Oh, that's so that's amazing. Cool.
Well, thank you. So we're going to have to go to a break, but thank you thank so you much, Elle, for joining us.
Absolutely.
It was really interesting, thank and you. I think I'm going to go and do some more paint by numbers, and then maybe I'll move on to taxi.
And then
we're going to
go to a drink and go to
I'll
us.
Let you know.
I got you, girl.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
FUBAR Radio.
Hello, we are back from the break, and we are sitting here with Fraser McDonald Lister. Mm. And thanks for joining us, Fraser. Fraser is a Movember ambassador and has been for 9 years, and is an activist for suicide prevention and mental health. You're also a member of the Dead Parent Club.
Whoop whoop! Welcome. The water is fine.
We love it.
And
there are cookies.
There are cookies. Oh my god! We should actually bring
cookies. There's chocolate milk.
And the founder of the Rugby Football Club, linked with Movember, and it is also World Mental Health Day
Awareness
on Thursday.
Day, yeah, for sure, 100%.
So there's a lot to cover.
Feels like this is going to be very important.
It does. Fraser, do you want to like start talking a little bit about, you know, kind of what's happened in your life that's kind of led
you here?
Yeah, sure. Proud member of the Dead Parents Society.
Yes!
I didn't actually realise that this was a thing outside of my small friendship group.
No.
Well, until right now?
Until right now, yeah.
Wow.
We've joked about this for ages.
This original idea, when we first talked about this back in the day, like a million years ago, was called the Dead Parent Club.
It's a great club.
It's great.
It is. It is a great club. It's one of those things that I feel like you can only kind of celebrate it if you're in it, because otherwise it feels really insensitive.
It's very much an in club.
Right? It
Absolutely.
Is an in club. Yeah, yeah. So, but
tell us about yourself.
Yeah, tell us your story and like how you lost your dad and kind of how did you get here today?
Yeah, I'll kind of try and tell it in broad strokes.
Yeah.
So I lost my dad when I was 16, and it wasn't something that was expected. My dad wasn't unwell. Mm. Ironically, he was actually out on a jog. He'd decided to get fit so that he could run the London 10K to raise some money for the Evelina Children's Hospital. They'd saved my life when I was a child. And he had been going on runs, and he went on this one particular run, and I was home from school. And we had a knock on the door, and somebody said, "There's a man collapsed in the road. Can you call emergency services? I didn't have a phone on me." And my mum called up to me. I was sat upstairs in my room, and she said, "Oh, Fraser, can you go and check it out?" Because I was a qualified first aider at the time with the Army Cadets. And so I was like, "Yeah, sure." So I ran out into the road, kind of barefoot in my joggers, looked, you know, how far up the hill it was, and there was my dad lying kind of prostrate on the ground. And so, you know, went up to him, was very much in medic mindset.
Yeah,
yeah, Dr. ABC, is there any danger? Can I get a response out of him? Check if his airways are clear. Is he breathing? And he wasn't. So I started giving him CPR. And to be honest, in hindsight, I knew he was dead when I found him. But I gave him CPR all the same for about 15 minutes until the ambulance arrived.
Wow.
And that was it. And I'm an only child. My family unit was a very close one. I was very close with both my parents. I still am very, very close with my mum, probably more so as a result of this.
Yeah.
And the timing was just prime, because it was 2 weeks before I sat my GCSEs.
Yep, 16.
And
brilliant.
My dad had always been a massive advocate of education. He'd had a really, really rough childhood in Glasgow, and was really keen that I didn't have to experience any of the hardship that he did. So he'd always been the biggest champion of my academics. And I was like, these exams are in 2 weeks. The last thing that he would have wanted would be for me to fail or delay them because of him, when he was the one who'd been driving me all this time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I just threw myself headfirst into it. I sat my exams. I got good results. I sat more exams for AS levels.
You.
I got good results. And it was great.
Like, yeah, but you're not processing anything that's happened.
There was a lot of well done you. Mm. And frankly, I think between good exam results and giving a killer eulogy...
Which, by the way, is a lot to be said for that.
It's hard.
I mean, I'm not used to this, but I'm good in front of a crowd.
Yeah.
I burnt the church down.
I don't doubt it. That roof.
And I think that between those two things, everyone sort of went, wow, he's processed this really well.
Yeah. I'm just completely, not to make this about me at all, but very similar, just so you know a little bit about us. So my dad died about, I think, like a month before my A-levels and had exactly the same thing. Was very much like, no, you're staying. When he had cancer, but it was like 6 weeks and then he died.
It was so
it was very like rapid. Mm. It was like, no, you make sure you're working. You're not giving up. I was working at fucking like Hotel Jocelyn or something once a week, and it was horrible. And it was like, you are not giving that up. You need to learn that it's important to work. You need to make sure you're revising. Mm. I was doing all of this and also helping plan the funeral, and also spoke at the funeral. And it's one of these things where you're kind of like, no, I can do this. I'm going to do this because my dad would like be, you know, be quite disappointed in me if I wasn't going to be continuing, you know, all his aspirations he had for me. And then people are sort of looking at you going, yeah, you're doing so well. You are so strong. And then you kind of go, I am strong. As it's like, you know, as if it's a really good thing. I've given myself a little sticker.
And then you just
kind of carry on and, you know, you just end up thinking that I need to be like that. And from what I've like heard, it's obviously there must have become a moment in your life when suddenly that did crumble or, you know, you couldn't deal with those pressures, understandably. Do you want to kind of talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, very much the case. So, as I said, you know, everyone, it looked like I was doing really well. The reality was probably quite different, but I didn't realise it at the time.
Yeah,
I mean, I wasn't sleeping well. I was taking Pro Plus to get through just my regular school periods, let alone anything else. I was kind of having 5 or 6 caffeine tablets a day.
Wow.
Eventually, went and spoke to a doctor because I was like, I'm tired all the time and it's really annoying. I was like, why am I tired all the time? Can you fix this? And they went, they asked me a load of questions that I thought were unrelated to tiredness and then pronounced me depressed.
Yep.
And
that's a mood.
And I was like, right, okay, at least now I know what the problem is. I can take my sertraline as it was at the time.
Hey, friend.
Well, used to be, not a fan.
Oh, well,
definitely
I am.
My least favourite SSRI. It is so funny how everything works differently for other people. And, you know, put them in my bag and went off to uni.
Yeah.
Wow.
And when I got to uni, I think a combination of the academic pressure, the sort of self-inflicted social pressure of kind of wanting to draw a line under it and be like, that was my past this life.
But it is. I always think of it as two lives. Yeah. You've lived two lives, right?
So it was like, this is my new life. I don't want to be the guy whose dad had died. Because everybody at school knew. I mean, they held an assembly to tell all of my year group what had happened while
Classics.
I was taking time off.
Classic Skinners.
Skinners was a phenomenal school.
They are amazing.
I could not have done what I did without them. So shout out to anyone at Skinners.
Shout
it's a great
out to
school.
Skinners.
They were really, really good. And I was then in an environment where I had no pastoral care.
It didn't take long
before my coping mechanisms, which were also, to be fair, just my social life, because I'm a rugby player and I did what rugby players do. I would play sports on a Wednesday, I would go out on a Wednesday, and then there was night out with other friends on a Thursday, and then there was Saturday night. And between late nights, heavy deadlines, lots of drinking, and ultimately, as I'm sure everybody can relate, sort of saying things, doing things, and just when you're under the influence of things like alcohol and in a really bad headspace that aren't the best reflection of yourself, finding myself in quite a lonely, isolated position. And it didn't take long before I went into full-on crisis mode, believed that everybody else would be better off without me, and tried to take my own life. And that was within my first year at uni.
So that's like quite heavy. I mean, you've said that, like, I don't know. How
well,
I've talked about this several times.
I know. I think it's very interesting talking about it from a place where you're clearly now in a space where you can communicate it. And I think it's super important that, especially, and I think women also struggle with stuff like this, but especially for men, it is such a huge stigma for men to have to be strong and have to not show any weakness. And the fact that you are talking about this out loud is such testament to your story and your conviction. And I think that is awesome. Look at me being serious for once.
I know. I'm on edge.
I don't know what's happening. Something's coming over me. But also, as someone who has felt exactly the same way, especially in their third year of uni, I completely understand where you're coming from. And it is such a weird thing. I think the biggest thing that I relate to with you right now is the idea that you didn't know it was happening. And I think that is exactly what was going on with me as well. You're kind of like, you're on autopilot and you're just pushing through whatever this pain in the back of your head is that you're just not going for. And you just push and push and push. And then one day something happens and you snap and you go, oh my God. And your whole world crumbles. And I've now been in therapy for, gosh, like two many, many years. But I think that it's so interesting how things from our past, whether however long they've been going, been far from you or yourself, they do affect you. And I think it's so important that we talk about this, and this is why we created this
exactly
podcast.
And it catches up with you as well. But what was the moment of you kind of seeing that, I don't know, and realizing
light,
that the seeing some clarity and seeing like, you know, I think I need some help, or like, did it get to the, I don't know, because I feel like, I don't really feel like I can comment on it because I haven't like been in that situation where I felt, you know, I've felt dark thoughts, but kind of been in that place. But what was it that kind of made you think, you know, did you have a good support network, friends, family? How did you kind of see the light in a cliche way?
It wasn't really any one thing. And actually, while that sounds like a convoluted answer that, you know, maybe doesn't provide people with solace, I actually think for anyone who's been in the situation I was in, it's a more realistic way of looking at it. Like,
absolutely.
For me, depression and suicide wasn't and still isn't, because I still, you know, have clinical depression. I manage it a lot better than I used to. It was never a case of, there was the moment where I decided to commit suicide. There was the moment where I started feeling better again. It's very much a continuum with lots of different levels going on. Now, you talk about support. I had support offered to me from the moment that my dad passed away.
Yeah.
I made a point of saying, I'm now the man of the house. I need to get to the best university I can, earn as much money as I can, as quickly as I can, and support my mum. That was where my head was at. And that was why the goal became fully stars at GCSE, fully stars at A-level, go to Oxford.
Wow.
And ironically, when I was at Oxford, I was studying human sciences, neuropsychopharmacology. I was literally studying the efficacy
the irony of
the SSRIs I was taking. I wasn't ignorant to what was going on. Like, I was fully aware that I had depression. Mm. But it's the, for me, what was lacking in that pre-suicidal period was my engagement with support. Mm. So I was going to therapy sessions.
Yep.
I was, in my mind, running rings around the people I was talking to.
I know exactly
This is fascinating.
Hubristic as it sounds, I thought I was cleverer than them.
Yep.
Yeah.
I thought that there was no way that they could understand what I was thinking, no matter how, partly because I had the academic background.
And you'd sussed yourself out.
I was reading the latest studies coming out of the BMJ and going, nobody understands depression, so this person definitely doesn't understand mine. And I wasn't opening any of the doors that I had locked, in fairness, 3 years before. So it wasn't like it was going to be easy. And I wasn't engaging with that help. I was going, but I wasn't there. And then there was a period of time of suicidal ideation, and a lot of people who go through a suicidal crisis will have a longer period of ideation, and that doesn't necessarily ever go away. I went for a long period of time where it kind of went from feeling bad about myself to imagining what it would be like if I wasn't being here to then you get to a point where you can't, it's invasive to the point of inescapable. I would be walking through my college and I would see a tree and go, that one would do.
Or
I'd walk past the college chapel and go, I know how to get up there.
Yep.
And you can't not think it.
Yep.
And then you get to a point where you have a plan.
Yep.
And then you get to the point of, I mean, I remember it really well. It was a morning lecture. I was sat in a biology lecture. The professor was talking at me, but I nothing was going in. And in the middle of that lecture, I in my head, I went, when I get home, I'm going to hang myself.
Yeah.
And I went home and I drank half a bottle of whiskey and I tried to do that. Now, fortunately, I am 6'2", for anyone on Hinge who's
I don't think we've matched.
I feel like we could didn't have the longest rope going, and it didn't really work. But to my mind, that was a suicide attempt because I wanted to go as much as I knew it wasn't really going to work because of the logistics. And then, you know, I'm now, gosh, I mean, that I must have been 18 or 19 when that happened. So I'm now sort of a good 7 years on. When I'm at my lowest, suicidal ideation comes back in. The difference now is that I've spent the last 7 years engaging properly with support. So the clarity that came was after that was the crisis for me. That was almost like I needed to go through that moment to prove to myself how badly I needed the help.
Yeah.
And that was when I called my friends. That was when I told my mum where I was at. And that was when I started making more of an effort. Ironically, the one thing I didn't do was stop, which is what I tell people to do now. Yeah. It's like, I didn't stop after my dad died.
Yeah.
I didn't stop after I had my suicidal episode. I was so desperate not to have to resit a year, right?
Yeah.
Priorities were just so out of whack. Yeah. And that was all on me. Like, no one was telling me to stay at uni. No one was telling me to go and do my GCSEs 2 weeks after dad died. But, and maybe that's one of the male angles of this. And it's certainly something we see a lot through Movember, is the insistence on delaying getting access to help as a man. Whether it's, you know, as a rugby player, I see it in my physical injuries as well. Yeah. I broke my thumb 4 weeks ago. My immediate thing was, I'm going to cover it in tape and get on with through. Things.
Have you managed though to slow down now? Has it?
No. I would love to say yes, but any of my friends who watch this will.
What do you think would happen if you slowed down? What do you think would happen?
Know.
Have you had like a week off?
I can just tell you. That's terrifying.
No, I relate that. It's horrible. I do not want to do anything like that.
I think that I do slow down, but slowed down is not slow.
No.
Yeah. I think is the honest truth of it. Okay,
let's talk about, I want to talk about loads of things, but I want to talk about rugby, Movember. How do these come into play?
So I guess that's the next part of the story, right? So I can't actually remember what time of year my suicide attempt was, but what I do remember is that shortly after that was Movember, and it was the first one I could actually partake in because it was the first time I could grow anything resembling facial
hair. Absolute slay.
and so I did it with my college rugby team. A few of us kind of piled in, grew some silly moustaches and raised about £1,000. And maybe it was...
And then the moustache stayed.
Maybe it was the future management consultant in me. But I looked at that and went, if someone was managing this, we could raise a lot more money. Mm. And I'm quite competitive. And I signed up to be a student ambassador and basically got given a platform, right? Amazing. And I do like talking, if you couldn't tell.
Yeah, no, I didn't. So I'm not really sure, really. I just seem kind of a quiet guy.
Yeah,
quite shy, quite demure.
They gave me a not very mindful. they gave me a platform, and I ran with it, and I shared my story, and I raised a lot of money. Mm. And then we raised a lot of money, because I then built a team, and then it was a university-wide thing. Mm. And then when I graduated and went to work in the corporate world, I became a workplace ambassador rather than a student one.
Mm.
And so I started leading fundraising at work. And three years on, we were the top fundraising company in Europe.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
And then it was 3 years ago, sort of during COVID, when we were all sort of, me and my rugby playing friends were missing that kind of rare opportunity that we get as guys to do a group activity, mm-hmm. get physical contact with one another. I mean, I know that people joke about sort of the heteronormativity of rugby,
it's very
there
true.
Is something about being able to have a safe space to like hold other people. And
hit something a little bit.
And hit it, like there's the nice contact and the more aggressive contact. but we decided that, well, loads of rugby players do Movember. Why isn't there a Movember rugby team? And so I asked my friends at headquarters if I could set it up, and they were a bit cautious about it because it had been done badly before. But I said, look, you can trust me. I've raised X amount for the charity. I've led the fundraising of Y. Yeah. Give me a shot. And I guess we're 5 years on since that first conversation. I think the club's only been running properly for 3 years. We now have a men's section with about 175 people in it, a women's section with 115, which is far, far better than our men's section, I might add.
Really?
It is. We've
this
got
is amazing.
As it is.
We've got international representation in our women's squad, and some very cool Mo sisters, as they're known. And we put out a student team, a women's team, and a men's team in the annual charity fundraising game. And then through the summer, we tour around Europe and to Dubai, where I'm off to in a few weeks, to compete at the international stage. Mm. The Mo Bros grow a moustache before they play if they can. The Mo Sisters all start their first game with a stick on.
Love it. Oh, that's amazing.
And we all just kind of, we're trying to create a safe space for those guys, but B, also for women within the game to understand where some of the issues that we have with men in the game come from.
Yeah, I think that's amazing.
Movember's real face of men's health report that's just come out is very much not just about men, it's about the way that men's health impacts us all.
Mm.
And I think that the relationship between men's and women's rugby teams within a club is, I like to think, one of the more progressive compared to friends who you don't hear about women's football teams interacting
teams.
With their men's teams. But in rugby clubs, it's getting better. And I think we've created a really good opportunity for friendships to grow, support mechanisms to grow. And we've got players from, you know, they all come from different clubs across the UK and Ireland and abroad. So building friendships that they can talk to when they're struggling.
It sounds like you've put in so much of this energy into something that's become so positive. And that is just ridiculously impressive. I know. Especially someone who's gone through something that's so...
And still be so positive about it, you know, and you've and I know you've probably still got your own, fighting your own demons and there's still so much there, but you have taken a lot of that and just gone, do you know what, I'm going to help people. And I think that is amazing.
I've also accidentally built what it was that I needed.
Yeah. Well, I guess you've created your own support network.
Only, only very recently have I started to use the support network for what it is. And, and it is amazing.
So as it's, I've got to wrap up, I'm really sorry. But as it's World Mental Health Day this week, is there a message that you'd like to give to wrap things up?
That is tough. Summarizing all experiences into one thing.
I know, that's a horrible question. I'm so sorry.
The best piece of advice I ever got was while I was doing a Movember challenge with a guy called Fergus Crawley, and we were halfway up Ben Nevis, and knees were screaming, and he just turned to me and he just said, look, no one feeling lasts forever. And I think that the thing that you lose when you are suffering from clinical depression is hope. And if someone's listening right now and they're looking at it and going, what I've achieved isn't achievable for them, you know, they're not going to get better. People would be better off without them. If I could have said, spoken to myself back in that room while I was at uni, is that it will get better. It will also get worse at some point. It will go up and down. But the point is that you will not stay in this state forever. The feeling will pass. And you just got to hang in there and talk to someone while you do it, because the climb up the mountain, it goes a lot quicker when you've got someone by your side to natter to.
Well, you've kind of explained that so
is the
well.
Perfect summary.
And yeah, it's such a good summary. Thank you so much, Fraser, being on here. And yeah, you're just smashing it. Cool. We're going to play a game, guys. We're going to play a game with Fraser. Fraser is sticking around. And we're going to play Higher or Lower. So it's quite a complicated game. What I'm going to
really
do.
I'm scared because Fraser's going to be so knowledgeable.
I know. Well, I know.
I wouldn't
I hope so.
It.
No. No pressure. This is all
so
for
too.
Fun. We're just going to learn some things. So I'm going to read out a question and you are simply going to say higher or lower and. We might have to swap things around.
This is scary because I'm also very competitive. Should we go to the closest 5%? Well, oh, no. Closest. No.
It's higher or lower, Tash.
Oh,
so it's like higher or lower.
Okay, so I'm losing already.
You're losing. Okay, I'm going to begin. So
he went to Oxford. This isn't fair.
Are we ready? I wish we had some game music. We should definitely have some game music. What percentage of adults in England experienced a common mental health problem such as depression or anxiety in the past week? Is it higher or lower than 15%?
Higher.
Correct. She was actually first.
Ding. Yasmin, are you taking score? Take score. So it's a draw so far.
It's actually around 17% of adults in England.
I thought it'd be much higher than that. Yeah.
Number two. Sorry, I don't mean to be so like brutal with this, as in that we're moving on. I do care about this. I just have to move on.
Becky, it's fine. This is a game.
Number two.
A fast game's a happy game.
The percentage of children and young people in England aged 5 to 16 who have a diagnosable mental health disorder, is it higher or lower than 15%?
Higher.
I'm going to go lower just for... Is that wrong?
Don't bother. It's obviously higher.
I don't
know. If Fraser says higher, it's going to be higher. I don't know who you think you are.
I just thought that maybe Yasmin would have done the ABAB system again.
Yeah, I know. This is what I did at school. I was just like, it's got to be. They haven't used A in a while. It's got to be A. Number three. Is the percentage of UK adults with a mental health problem who received treatment in 2022 higher or lower than 40%?
Lower.
Is the percentage... Say that again.
Is the percentage of UK adults with a mental health problem who received treatment in 2022 higher or lower than 40%?
I'm going to go lower, just, you know, for...
It's higher.
Ah! Is it really?
It is higher. It's 46%.
I knew I should.
I'd be interested as to what treatment is.
What percentage of men in the UK reported feeling so stressed that they felt overwhelmed or unable to cope? Is it higher or lower than 40%?
Higher. It's got to be higher.
It's lower.
No
According
way.
To the survey by the Mental Health Foundation, 37% of UK men reported feeling so stressed that they felt overwhelmed or unable
Fair
to cope.
Enough.
I mean, I don't know where these stats have come from, but it does say a survey by the Mental Health Foundation. So.
You're not supposed to admit that we don't know where the stats come from.
Well, I haven't written them.
This is a well-researched podcast.
Yes, it is. It is.
It actually is.
Yasmin is the best producer, and she is on her shit.
She is on her shit. I do believe these.
Yeah, I do believe these.
We have one more question. In England, what percentage of adults experienced suicidal thoughts in 2022? Is it higher or lower than 10%?
2022, we're middle COVID. So
yeah, that is middle COVID, isn't
that
it?
It's higher.
It's lower. It's 8.
Really? We're not very good at this.
Do you know why, Fraser? It's because we are the same. And we both have clinical depression.
But
the clinically depressed members are always worse.
To make Fraser feel slightly better, you did win.
Oh, gosh.
By 1 point, apparently.
Unbelievable.
So I'm really sorry.
Yasmin, I can't believe you didn't fix that for me.
I like this higher or lower game.
I take it back.
Oh, thank you so, so much, Fraser, for being here. Thanks for the game. And
really,
I hope you're pleased you're a winner.
Yeah. Go forth.
Bye. We're back with Death, a Funny Business.
We are back.
How are you feeling?
I mean, apart from the fact I'm shedding an egg, as one would say, I'm surfing.
What does that mean in layman's terms?
I'm surfing the crimson wave. I am grieving the loss of an egg today. I have started my period. It's been quite intense.
I don't really understand. I actually don't understand the cycle, which is really, really bad.
What? Okay, you need to start living. Okay, for all my menstrual gals out there, my menstrual pals, live your life by your cycle.
I know everyone keeps saying this.
It changes your world. You have to look at your month like a year. I am in winter right now, which means don't laugh. I'm self-caring. I'm letting this thing out of me. It's very intense.
And that's grieving. That's the going. And
yes, I would say if we've got to, you know, if we're being on brand, it's definitely a grieving process in a way. You are shedding something that's quite painful at the end of the day. Like, let's be real. I don't know how your periods are, but
I don't have periods. I know.
Wait, what?
I know.
Why?
I'm on the coil.
She's on the coil.
Oh. I know. It's so nice though.
That is nice for you. I'm glad that you get on with that. Do you like that?
It's great for most situations.
I bet.
I know.
This podcast, this show isn't about life, Becca. It's about death.
But grief is like, death is about cycles.
Absolutely.
And
this is a thing. Your period is
important. No, I kind of want to be more in touch with my female self. And I do sometimes think if I was to grieve an egg, then I'd feel better. But
you know what? I'm not sitting there like taking my period blood and putting it in a special box and crying about it. But
I just pictured that so well.
I'm so glad. I really hope everyone's like seeing me do that, like, that's kind of cool. I'm joking. I actually collect all my tablets. No, I'm joking. That's disgusting. It's not disgusting, it's natural. Point is, I think it's very important for us to remember that things are coming multitudes. We grieve things in all kinds of ways. One of my friends has just gone out of a little situationship, and she was telling me she was a bit sad about it, and I was like, yeah, aren't we all? It doesn't matter what level of relationship you have with something, you can be grieving something even in the slightest way.
No, I completely agree with that.
Sometimes on your period, you need to have a little cry. You need to go with your cycle.
I'm grieving the fact that I didn't get enough sleep last night, to be honest.
Are you?
Yeah.
What happened? Were you just too hot?
I was just...
Too cold?
I don't know, it was like batch cooking. It's really not exciting. I just decided to suddenly got this energy, and I thought, right, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to cook.
What did you cook? Honestly,
really not interesting. It was just like pasta and something.
Nice.
But I'm grieving sleep.
Good
and
you,
what else am I grieving? I'm grieving...
Well, we've just done a pretty heavy segment about the loss of people's parents.
Well, that's why
intense.
I thought it was nice to kind of be a bit more lighthearted. Absolutely. In terms of like, I'm grieving, like I could do with a bit of extra dosh in my bank account.
Oh yeah.
Some grief. What else are you grieving?
What am I grieving? I am grieving this week.
Why?
I had a big cry on Sunday.
Like
so,
actual grieving.
Yeah, like actual grieving.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, it depends what people class as grieving, but I, for those of you who don't know, I'm an actor.
Like you say, well, you were like waiting for me to do that.
I've been waiting for Rebecca to just like let me. I love that I call you Rebecca as well. Sorry.
Oh no, you are.
Oh yes, I am. Right, there we go. I've just been on tour for 2 months. We've just been the craziest tour. Been all over the place. The East Midlands have been living it.
Wow.
Up. It has been wild. I've been in Ipswich, Norwich,
Bury St. Edmunds.
It's been just humbling. An absolute storm of cute, quaint.
They're actually really, I actually think they're really cute.
They are really cute. We've had a great time. But yeah, we've just finished the show that we created together. And we all get along really well, the cast and the crew and everyone. And we've had the best time. And it's just been...
Build those bonds.
We had just the best time. And it's crazy when you create something together. I think you'll understand this as a creative.
I completely get this. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm picturing
you'll understand this as a creative, and you create this microcosm of a family, mm-hmm. actually, that becomes, you know, you're eating breakfast together and you're eating lunch together and you're having naps in the same room because you're exhausted and all kinds of random stuff. And you're sharing this, especially on stage, you're sharing this very serious experience every night. And when it ends, it is something overwhelming. I actually spoke to my therapist about it because I have a therapist who I love. Shout out to Dr. Emily. She's amazing. And I said to her on Friday, we were finishing on Saturday, I said to her, I'm really worried I'm not going to cry. I'm really worried that I'm going to feel nothing. I'm really worried I'm going to protect myself.
So you were already thinking about, like, I'm not going to grieve, like, I'm before you even kind of said your goodbyes.
I'm just going to take the piss, and I'm not going to, like, I'm not going to acknowledge it. And she went, why do you think you're going to do that? And I went, I don't know. I just feel like I'm probably, and then she went, and what would it feel like for it to end? And I literally just went, and I'm like crying. And
she's like, what they're doing, don't they? They always say that, and it's like, is it the way you said it or what you said? Well, but it's just, they're answering your own questions.
Exactly. But she also said to me, and I would love to share this with the humans.
With the humans.
With the humans. That's who you are, who are listening.
As opposed to the minions.
As opposed to the minions. She said to me, it's, and I said, I don't know why I'm crying. And she said, I think it's because you've been given the permission. Mm. You've been given the permission from someone else who said, it's okay, you can cry. Mm. It's absolutely fine. And I've gone, oh, okay, great. Let me just let it all out. And it's true. The moment you give yourself the permission to feel things, and I think that as someone, especially someone who's grieved a parent,
you bear a lot of responsibility.
You bear
You've got
so
all
much,
of that. And you haven't got the time, like speaking to Fraser, you know, you don't have the time to cry, you don't have the time to kind of do that. And you've got to be there, I mean, as an older sister, and you've got
as
to
a
be
performer,
there
as a,
everything.
As a worker?
As a worker woman.
As a professional.
Yeah. You have to be, you have to kind of put it together. And suddenly, someone says, you know, it's okay. You can.
Yeah, you can cry.
You can cry.
Are you going to cry?
You can cry. Are you going to cry?
I'm going to cry. No, I'm kidding. I'm not going to cry.
I don't give you permission right now.
Okay, fine. Anyone who's listening, you have permission to cry. I give you that space. And if you want to cry with us right now, I think you should.
Well, it's been a pretty pretty heavy episode, right?
It has.
But it's been really interesting. I feel like I've learned a lot about, you know, I know there's like so many different parts to grief, and like grief triggers so many, you know, different things and mental health. And I think I need to kind of sit and think about this tonight and go and kind of learn from like Fraser and what he said. And I actually sometimes find it quite difficult to know what to say. And it's really interesting me being on the other side of it, because normally if I say, oh, my dad's dead, people go, they don't know what to say, right?
And he's like, cool, and what?
And cool, and what, right? And he's kind of, you know, and Fraser's like and opened like, up and said, you know, I tried to commit suicide. I honestly felt like I was on that other side.
So interesting.
Of someone saying, you know, someone's me telling my dad's dead. That's how it felt. Mm. And I felt quite sort of taken back, because I think I knew what I wanted to say. And this is just me being completely honest now, but I knew what I wanted to say, but I didn't know how to say it. And I just think it's really interesting from me being on the other side of it. And it's all tied into grief and mental health.
Absolutely.
But I think my biggest takeaway from this is that no one knows what to say.
No.
And it might, you know, I think we do just have to like listen to each other and just take it on board. Mm. And now I don't actually know what I'm saying anymore.
No, I completely agree with you. And I think it's such a good point for people who are listening, who are either in that position, because sometimes you're not grieving anymore, or you're in a position where you have to help someone who's grieving
and not being through
or
it.
Not even grieving, or just talking about it. And even that part is hard. Like, you just might be experiencing a friend who is going through bereavement, or a friend who is going through the grief of something, and sometimes you're not gonna know what to say, and that's also so okay. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's interesting that you said that, because your and Fraser's experience are similar in many ways. With the kind of suddenness and the father figure, and even in those similarities, sometimes we don't know how to communicate with other human beings to reach out and to
but
share.
But we're all
that.
Here and we're talking about it, and that's what we do on death a funny business.
Oh, it
right?
is. And so we wouldn't want it any other way.
Absolutely not. Thank you so much to all of our guests today. Oh. Thank you to Fraser. Thank you to Elle. And thanks, Tash. Natasha.
Oh, stop it. Anytime, Rebecca. You can. If you need me, call me, no matter where you are.
Can I fade her down?
No matter how far.